In my family, education means cultivating wisdom and virtue by teaching what is good, true, and beautiful. Memoria Press makes this type of education possible with their classical Christian curriculum. Characterized by simplicity, quality, and affordability, Memoria Press gives my children a rich classical education. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Pictures change how people feel about abortion. Facts and arguments change how they think, and both are vital for changing behavior.
Where do we find Jesus, and how do we get in touch with him? And the contention of the scriptures is that Jesus comes to us by means of that word which is preached and the sacraments which we receive.
The Democratic Party watching out for the corporate interests of the abortion industry, we don't protect any other corporation as a party, so this should be no different.
For God so loved the world is not the gospel, because he loves everybody, even the people that will go to hell, God still loves.
An hour from now, we're going to play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. That's just a sample of the four soundbites we will play for you in 1 hour. Then you'll listen, you'll give us a call, send us an email, send us a tweet, or go to our Facebook fan page and vote for Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. And we'll give away the LPR bundle package to the listener with the best vote for Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. Frequent winner of Soundbite of the Week is Dr. Jennifer Roback-Moore. She joins us now on this Friday afternoon for part four of a weekly series on the sexual revolution. Today, we're going to talk about two related things, cohabitation and divorce. She's founding president of the Ruth Institute based in San Marcos, California. She taught economics for 15 years at Yale and George Mason Universities, and she's author of the new book, The Sexual Revolution and Its Victims. Jennifer, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks for having me on. Hey, I didn't know I won these prizes. So what's my prize for being Soundbite of the Week here, man?
You don't win the prize, but your soundbite wins according to our listeners' vote. You're a frequent winner. Yeah, you are popular with our listeners. We're going to be talking about two issues as separate issues just for the sake of clarity of the conversation, but you need to explain at the outset that cohabitation has a direct connection to the eventual outcome of divorce. How is that?
Well, it actually works both ways, Todd. That people who cohabit prior to marriage are actually more likely to get divorced than people who do not cohabit prior to marriage. So you could say cohabitation causes divorce. But on the other hand, one risk factor for cohabiting in the first place is, were your parents divorced? Because we find that people whose parents were divorced, as those people grow up and try to form relationships of their own, quite often they have a lot of anxiety about it. They have a lot of fear about it. They lack confidence as to whether they can sustain lifelong married love themselves. And so it isn't unusual for people whose parents divorced to become the very ones who cohabit. So it kind of goes both directions, you know, that cohabitation causes divorce and divorce causes cohabitation.
All right, then let's talk a little bit about cohabitation. I think that I've heard this numerous times in the course of casual conversation, pastoral conversation, you name it, the whole idea that it would just be foolhardy to marry someone without a test drive of the potential spouse. What are your thoughts there?
Well, you know, that thought works great if you think of yourself as the person doing the test drive. It stinks if you think of yourself as the car being test driven, because what you're really doing there is you're reducing the other person to an object. And the car doesn't have any feelings if you drop it off at the lot and decide not to buy it. You know, but another person will have some feelings about it. And those feelings, they'll have the feelings not only when they get dumped at the lot, but those feelings color the whole relationship while you're living through it. So it's one of those analogies that people invent to kind of almost change the subject. But the analogy reveals that the person doesn't really see that this is a personal human relationship and not, it's not like purchasing an object. The decision of whom to marry is not like picking out a house to buy.
What about the idea that is probably maybe one step removed from that. At least someone who says, I'm going to test drive her before I marry her, has at least the pretense of saying, I'm thinking about marriage at some point in the future. But cohabitation has come in many cases to simply be a wholesale substitute for marriage. Talk about that.
Well, yes. So the cohabitation experience means different things to different people. And sometimes it means different things to different people, even inside the couple, you know. So it wouldn't be unusual, for example, for a couple to move in together and the woman to see that as a step towards marriage. And the man may see it as a perfectly acceptable long-term situation. If that's what's going on inside the couple, that couple's got a problem because they've got to somehow negotiate those peculiar expectations, you know, that they're really not on the same page. They're living in an intimate relationship, but they don't really know the other's mind as well as they think they do. Now, if you step back from the personal and look at the big overall sociological picture, you know, and you let's say you don't know the individuals, but you're just looking at big trends, there are different types of cohabitation. There are people who move in together, you know, 6 months before they're getting married, and they know they're getting married. Then there are people who move in together and have no intention of ever getting married and have, you know, one, two kids together, and maybe then think that they're going to get married. And then there are other people who move in together and they're really afraid of commitment. They're afraid of long-term commitment. And as soon as somebody says, let's get married and have kids, the relationship blows up and they separate. And when that happens, that's particularly heartbreaking, or can be particularly heartbreaking, particularly to the woman, if she has been counting on there being, you know, a long-term relationship, and her fertility is going away over time, you know, and now this relationship that she's invested a lot in, you know, nothing's there. And so what will also sometimes happen is what is called serial cohabitation. You move in with one person, it doesn't work out. So you break up and you move in with another person, it doesn't work out, you move in with yet another person. That pattern turns out to be one of the most harmful patterns that one can have in terms of your long-term prospects for yourself and for your children having a happy and stable life.
Why do you say that cohabitation is a social injustice?
Well, the widespread acceptance of social of cohabitation, I think, has created a cultural climate that's particularly harmful to poor people and to uneducated people. And the educated classes have kind of created this idea that marriage is just a piece of paper, it's not really important, doesn't really matter. Matter of fact, women would be better off if they never got married because it's too hard to get out of it, and what if you marry an abusive guy? You know, whole litany of anti-marriage complaints, you know, are leveled against marriage. And for most women, the alternative to cohabitation is not to live a life of celibacy or to become a lesbian or something. The alternative to cohabitation, the alternative to marriage for most women is cohabitation, right? And so women are being scared off from marriage, which has some prospect, at least, of giving them their long-term desires, and driven into cohabitation. And that's more likely to happen the lower down the income ladder that you get. And so then when you look at families that are, you know, there are children involved particularly, and you have cohabitation, you have serial cohabitation, compared to marriage, that is a much worse situation for women and children both than is marriage. And so the educated elites have basically created a situation that kind of works for them, that is kind of convenient for them, that is kind of hipster for them, if you will, but is really very difficult and problematic for poor people. And that's what I call a social injustice. You know, you're doing something that benefits you, and you're not taking any account of the harm that you're inflicting on people less fortunate than yourself. I think that's a problem, and I think young, idealistic college students should be aware of that. You know, that when they're being told these things, that that marriage is a bad deal and women would be better off cohabiting than marrying, you know, this is a long, long way from the whole story. And they're really participating in something that is not going to be helpful.
Dr. Jennifer Roback-Morse is our guest. We're doing part four of a weekly series with her on the sexual revolution. Today we're talking about cohabitation. And when we come back, we'll turn to the subject of divorce. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues Etc.
What we need as a goal is to raise a generation of Christians who actually believe that truth is not a matter of opinion, that a college education, while good, is not more important than children, that a successful career, while fulfilling, is not more fulfilling than a faithful and steady marriage.
Pastor Jonathan Fisk, speaking at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
Where what we believe about who Jesus was and how he saved us influences how we treat each other all the time. Where we teach his words because he's God, whether or not we like those words. And if we don't like them, our first action is not to try to make them go away, but to find out how and why they're right. Where the good news is yelled every single day by all of us at our dinner table to our kids. Listen, God is calling.
You can listen to Pastor Fisk's presentation, Making the Case for the Church's Response to Postmodernism, on an audio DVD from the Making the Case conference. For a donation of $300 to Issues Etc. before Labor Day, we'll send you this audio DVD. For more information, look for the DVD logo at issuesetc.org. About the sexual revolution today, cohabitation and divorce, with Dr. Jennifer Roback-Morse, part of the series with her on the sexual revolution. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Dr. Morse is a founding president of the Ruth Institute based in San Marcos, California. She taught economics for 15 years at Yale and George Mason Universities, and she's author of the new book, The Sexual Revolution and Its Victims. You can find out more about this book at issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Jennifer, back in 2005, you wrote this, and I want you to explain it. You say, "I have often thought that if people worked as hard at making marriage work as they do at making divorce work, they might stay married." What do you mean?
Well, I've heard that from so many people, Todd. I can't even tell you. You know, when I first started talking about these issues way back in 2001 with Love and Economics, you know, which is the book that you and I met each other over, you know, I'd talk about the harms of divorce to children, and people would come up and say this to me, you know, "If I had known how hard divorce was, I would have worked harder at my marriage." And the reality is that people think that when they get divorced, they're going to solve problems. They're going to end the conflict between them. They're going to, you know, eliminate the contact they have with the other person. And the truth is that people end up, the problems still are present. They just get transferred to a new arena. And so the problems that you had before quite often just play out, but with the family court standing in the middle of it. And so a lot of the problems simply are not going to go away, particularly in what is called a low conflict marriage. You know, if there's brutality or substance abuse or something like that, yes, separating from a person like that, that'll solve some problems. That's for sure. But absent that type of situation, you know, if you've got conflict or low level discontent or those type of problems, they're not going to go away. Quite often, you're just going to end up having to solve those problems with an attorney and the family court in the middle of it, costing you more money, more time, and ratcheting up a lot of the bad feelings. So that's what a lot of people discover to their dismay when they think they've solved a problem by getting divorced, and then they find out, no, it turns out not to be true.
You say it's not just the problem of divorce, period, but it's the problem of no-fault divorce, which you say created unilateral divorce. What's wrong with no-fault divorce and its result in one party being able to decide it's over?
Well, what it means is that the marriage is less binding a contract than many other contracts in society. when you a fault-based system or a system where you could only get divorced for cause, that protected people in the event that there was a marital fault, such as adultery or abuse or something, or abandonment. You know, a divorce in that setting allowed people to separate and be protected from the ill effects of the marital fault. With no fault, what has happened is that one person can end the marriage with or without any kind of fault on the part of the other person. They don't have to present evidence. They don't have to secure the other person's consent. You know, what the specialist will tell you, Todd, is back in the day of no fault, when two people really wanted to get divorced and there was no big fault going on, the only way they could get divorced is that they had to collaborate. They had to work together. They had to say, okay, honey, it's over. Let's put a stop to this. You know, you're going to pretend to have an affair, and I'm going to hire a detective to take pictures of you, and we're going to get this solved, and we're going to be separated, and we're both going to be better off. They could only do that if they both thought they were going to be better off, because you wouldn't cooperate with that set in that setting if you didn't think you were going to be better off. So what you have now, and so a lot of the people, just to back up, the reason people said, oh, no, fault-based divorce is terrible, is because they didn't like all that collusion and lying and sneaking around and so on. They thought that's so expensive, it's so pointless. Well, actually, the point of it was that they had to both agree to it. When you have a no-fault system, one person can leave for any reason or no reason. They don't have to give an account of themselves. They don't have to give evidence on anything. And so that means quite often, probably 2/3 of divorces are of this kind, Todd, where one party would like to stay married and the other party wants a divorce. Quite often there's a sweetie in the background. There's a new love interest in the background. So the person who was constrained by no fault divorce, by fault-based divorce, namely the adulterer, that person is the one who gets to run off scot-free and do whatever they want, you know.
We've got about 20 seconds here, Jennifer.
Yeah, the court takes sides, the law takes sides with the person who wants the marriage the least. And that is the big problem with no-fault divorce.
Well, we're going to take up the subject of divorce the next time we talk with Dr. Jennifer Roback-Morse. There's so much more to say about it in part 5 of a weekly series with her on the sexual revolution. Dr. Jennifer Roback-Morse is founding president of the Ruth Institute based in San Marcos, California. She taught economics for 15 years at Yale and George Mason Universities, and she is author of the new book, The Sexual Revolution and Its Victims. Jennifer, I look forward to next time.
Me too. Thanks.
When we come back, it's hour 2 of Issues, Etc., and we're going to take up the subject of an openly homosexual volunteer choir director at Hillsong Church. Now, that sounds like choir director, come on. But put Hillsong Church at the end of that sentence, and it becomes much more significant. Hillsong Church is the most influential church in the entire world, and there have been rumblings about a change in its policy, its beliefs, and its stance on homosexuality for a long time. Pastor Chris Roseborough of Fighting for the Faith will be our guest. We'll take up that subject in This Week in Pop American Christianity.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.